Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We've seen the videos from the streets of San Francisco, where an older Asian woman or man is beaten and attacked for no reason. Mass shootings targeting a certain group, race, and ethnicity. And specifically in our area, anti-Semitic symbols left on both Sac State and UC Davis campuses or hung on freeway overpasses for all to see. If you think you've been hearing more about hate crimes over the past couple of years, especially since the start of the pandemic, you'd be right. According to a recently published report, the California Attorney General's office says hate crimes are at their highest reported level in 20 years, up just 32%, even when just comparing 2020 to 2021. Now, that includes crimes against Hispanics, the LGBTQ plus community, African Americans, but the highest rise in hate crimes targeted Asian Americans, up 177%. Now, California is making it easier to report these types of crimes. CAP Radio's race and equity reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan, joins us now with details on the new Commission on the State of Hate and the resources available for reporting cases. Sarah, thanks for being here today. Good morning.
Of course. Thank you for having me, Vicky.
I mean, the rise in the number of incidents, I mean, it just speaks for themselves. But is that what sparked the creation of this new commission, or has this been in the works for some time?
Yeah, it has been in the works for some time. I think the bill was initially proposed by Assembly member or former state Assembly member Richard Bloom back in 2019, but it was just recently passed this September. It was created with the idea of being a commission with representatives from many of California's diverse communities, bringing them together so that they could help analyze and suggest policy solutions to hate crimes when they occurred in the state. And now, of course, it's shifted to more aggressively looking at that rise in hate crimes and really having this commission kind of work with policymakers to address rises that they see. And of course, since 2020, as you said, reported hate crimes have risen about 32% overall, according to a recent report from the state attorney general's office. So that's a pretty significant rise. But here's Assemblymember Bloom.
The steep rise in hate crimes and incidents come at a time where public confidence in our government institutions is also at an all-time low. Justice can seem evasive as extremists are emboldened by the reckless hate speech and dog whistling that comes from some of the most powerful places in our societies at times. It's my sincere hope that as commissioners, the diverse backgrounds and expertise that each of you bring to the table will help to bolster the vision of the commission.
All right. So who is this commission? Who are the people behind it? And what are the goals of the commission?
Sure. Yeah. So there is a representative from the Asian American community, a representative from the African American community, the Latino community, the LGBTQ community, and the Jewish community. And then I believe they have statewide expert Brian Levin, who just he studies hate at the, I think, at Cal State Santa Barbara, I want to say. So he's at the Center for Hate and Extremism there.
So an academic component to it as well.
Yes, definitely. So there are community members, there are academics who study the rise in hate and white supremacy. Overall, it's a really great makeup, I would say. And they had a lot of really great things to talk about. But just nuts and bolts of what the bill outlines for this commission. Commissioners are expected to hold 4 public forums a year. And they'll be producing a yearly report on the state of hate in California. Their very first report is going to be due in July of 2023. So we can expect to see that then. Overall, the commission's purpose is to really try to bridge that gap between the many nonprofit organizations that are currently collecting data on hate crimes independently. So organizations like Stop AAPI Hate, who do a great job at it. But the numbers just, you know, I think the state would like to have some sort of formal state backup organization to be looking at these numbers. And of course, just coordinating with state agencies that have also been collecting their own data on hate crimes. Everyone on the commission also acknowledged that despite seeing a rise in reported hate crimes over the past 2 years, a lot of hate crimes and incidents are still going underreported. And so the commission will also be looking to build a better connection between the state and underrepresented communities who may not always feel comfortable coming forward.
Well, maybe one solution to this, which we're going to get to, is that there's also a statewide hate crime hotline. So what is the status of this hotline? Is it up and running?
Absolutely. Yes. I'm sure for those of us who have been following just the state's response to the rise in hate crime since 2020, I am sure at some point you must have heard about this promised hate crime hotline. It actually ran into a couple snafus over the summer and over the past few years. So it had not come to fruition yet, but it is online now. Essentially, we had a commissioner, Cynthia Che, who's representing the Asian American community. She asked the Civil Rights Department about an update on the hate crimes hotline. Here she is.
I was actually very excited to hear that this was a program, but maybe 2 years ago, there was an issue of staffing and capacity. So I wonder if you could speak to that. And then also the ability to provide these services for community members whose primary language is not English.
Yeah, some really great points that she makes there. I don't know if the Civil Rights Department has yet created the answers to all of her requests here, but I can confirm that it is up and running. The department was able to secure more funding this past summer. And so it is running. You can call it now. And there is better staff equipped to handle the hotline.
So like the groundwork is being laid, but logistically still in a scaling up process for what is a new service for reporting hate crimes across California. When it comes to the commission and their priorities, what are some of the first issues that they want to tackle?
A number of commissioners mentioned trying to figure out solutions for how police interact with vulnerable communities, how to address the fear that some of these communities feel in contacting law enforcement, and how to keep hate crime policies from disproportionately incarcerating people with mental health problems or unhoused people, since that's a big worry. The Civil Rights Department of California is also it's also recently been renamed. The department was formerly known as the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. So if you didn't recognize that name, Civil Rights Department, there it is. They will be specifically working with the commission to tackle that rise in hate crimes. And they're hoping that their kind of rebrand will kind of shift people's mindset to realize that this is the department that you bring hate crime incidents too.
And you bring up a really important point, because there's an important piece to that, and that is building or rebuilding trust with communities where that trust may have been broken. So when it comes to the concerns about people with mental or emotional challenges and the possibility that they might be disproportionately targeted because of this hotline, how is the commission addressing this?
Yeah, I think this is a really important line that the commission is going to have to toe. I think all the commission members agreed that this was an important point to just keep in mind. Some commissioners brought up the fact that in New York City, people brought in accused of hate crimes were often first-time offenders. And a recent report just from this past year of the offenders who were brought in, 40% of those accused were classified as suffering from mental health challenges, which is absolutely just something we've got to be aware of. And at the same time, it was also brought up that Los Angeles County has a local hate crime division. And when they were asked to go through their caseload, all the cases that were set to be prosecuted were pretty clear-cut hate crimes. Here's Commissioner Brian Levin talking about what he's heard in Los Angeles.
There were only 3 felonies in the pipeline. 2 were attempted murders against transgender people, and 1 was an attack on a Black motorist by a shovel-wielding racist who did stiff arm salutes while his partner said White Lives Matter. So it's not like we're prosecuting a lot of these under hate crime laws to begin with. And some work that was done by San Francisco some years ago showed that, in particular with regard to transgender, we were not seeing convictions under the hate crime statute. So we need to do more work with this, but also have it be a bit elastic.
Okay, so the state also has some frameworks to work off of, local investments to tackle hate crimes from Los Angeles and New York City. When it comes to money, how is this hotline funded? What kind of personnel is staffing the hotline? And what do we know about their training?
Sure, yeah, nuts and bolts on the hotline, which is, by the way, going to be separate from the commission's efforts, just so that people understand. But the money for this hotline is coming specifically from funds allocated by the legislature during its last session to go towards this hotline. They didn't say exactly what kind of personnel is needed, but the goal is to use the hotline to collect data on trends of hate crimes happening across the state. So it's not necessarily a solutions hotline, just so that people are aware of that. That was something that I was not necessarily clear on either, but it seems that this hotline is really more supposed to be like a streamlined data collection service for people. There are three people that the state has hired specifically to focus on analyzing this data. One person is coming from the federal government's hate crimes unit. They've got a civil rights attorney, and I believe they have one more person from formerly from the federal government. They have funding for the next 3 years, and they hope the hotline can be a way not just to track hate crimes, but also to find out what's the best way for hate crimes to be addressed that works for individual communities.
So let's kind of walk through, I mean, from what you know, because this is still building up and this is still taking shape. But from what you know, what happens when someone makes a call? What is the process like and how are these calls vetted?
Yes. So at the moment, this hate crimes hotline seems to truly be a way for state just to collect data on what's happening. The Civil Rights Department didn't go into details about the exact process of what happens when you call in on that line. But from what I've read in their literature, those who call in are simply doing so to report an incident. I think you'll probably leave a report on a recorded line, and then follow-up is going to happen in the form of an email that's going to connect the victim to resources. The perpetrator is not going to be contacted. The department also specifies that anyone, even bystanders, can report a hate crime or hate incident, and it can be done anonymously. I assume staff at the hate crimes unit are then going to go through if they deem reports to be valid or not, but I haven't been able to officially verify that point with the department.
And I know, understood, we're talking about a phone number, but I don't know about everybody else. I don't really remember a lot of phone numbers, you know, especially with cell phones and we have a contact list. But there's also an online option as well.
Yes, absolutely. So people looking to file a hate incident or hate crime with the hotline can do so at the state's Civil Rights Department website. There's a full form that can be filled out there. The website is stophate.calcivilrights.ca.gov.
Yeah, and we, of course, have that information on our Insight page. And for those who do want the phone number, what is the number to the hotline?
Absolutely. For those looking to call and voice that, the number is 1-833-8-NO-HATE. So that's, again, 1-833-8-NO-HATE.
Sarah, thank you so much for your reporting and joining us this morning.
Of course. Thank you so much, Vicky.
Sarah Mizestan is CAP Radio's race and equity reporter. We have all of this information, including the online link and the hotline number, on our Insight page. Up next, it's been nearly 3 months of ongoing protests about Iran, and the country's government continues to be in the world spotlight for the treatment of its people. We'll have a conversation about the latest developments in the unrest and how the Iranian community in California is responding. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Nearly 3 months ago, the death of a 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman in the custody of Iran's morality police ignited massive protests. Since Mahsa Amini's death, the protests led by women and the country's youth have plunged the country into political turmoil. The Iranian government confirms at least 300 Iranians have been killed in the nationwide protests so far, but human rights groups believe that number is far higher. fire. According to the United Nations, at least 14,000 have been detained, including children. Coupled with the government taking an even more drastic step, approving the option of a death penalty as a sentence. The turmoil also spilled onto the global stage as the world at the World Cup in Qatar. Dr. Sahar Rezavi is the director of the Iranian and Middle East Studies Center at Sacramento State and joins us with more about the latest developments and how the Iranian community in California is responding. Professor Rezavi, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Great to be here.
You joined us almost 2 weeks ago following Mahsa Amini's death. Now we're talking as we're approaching 3 months of deadly unrest. Did you envision these global protests, which really have just spanned countries across the world, carrying to the end of the year and even potentially into the new year?
I didn't exactly anticipate that they were going to last this long and be this sustained, only probably because of my own cynicism and knowledge of how repressive and violent the responses by the government have been in the past. So I'm incredibly heartened to see that people continue to be on the streets in Iran and express their solidarity outside of Iran. But I admit it is lasting longer than I had initially thought it might.
And the developments, you know, sometimes are daily or throughout the day. If you just go online, I mean, it encompasses global events as well. And we can get into the World Cup in just a few moments. But have you had moments, given that, you know, your understandable cynicism because of historically what has happened, have you had moments where you kind of slow the clock and you begin to process everything that's unfolding into a larger context for Iran and Iranian Americans?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Iranians have been in this position before. They have a long history of dissenting against the government across successive regimes. There's a long history of opposition. So when you stop and you reflect and you kind of contextualize this in the broader history of Iranian social movements, you see that it's very clear that they know what to do. They know what needs to be done if they are going to get their demands met. It's just a matter of really being able to do them. And of course, there are obstacles for all kinds of reasons, but it's not a surprise that they are as tenacious as they are and as courageous as they are, given that they are very aware of all of the political developments that have been shaping their lives in the last 100 years.
For the Iranian diaspora here, I mean, there is strong solidarity, but also from conversations that I've had, there's also these conflicting emotions for a culture that they love, coupled with a tremendous amount of anguish of what's happening. You are the director of the Iranian and Middle East Studies Center at Sacramento State. How has your center been a place of support, even if it's informal?
Yeah, so we have been trying to bring together some voices from different communities across campus. A lot of people have expressed their desire to support the movement. There are some campus kind of protests that happen either here at Sac State or at Davis that we are trying to be involved with. At this point, it has been mostly a place where people come to get information and to connect with other people who are also in the same position that they are, which is, as you said, this great anguish in watching what's happening, feeling like they are too far away to do anything directly supportive, and really quite interested, I don't want to say desperate, that's probably overstating it, but extremely concerned to try to lend their support in some way that's more effective than just a hashtag online. Not that that's not important, but people want to do more than that.
Would you say that there's an overall consensus or an agreement about what's happening, or are there also maybe some disagreements about the protests?
I've seen disagreements, certainly, out in the world and online, on the internet, of course. All disagreements can be found
online. That's easy to find.
Right, exactly. But on campus, I have to say, the overwhelming consensus is support for the protests, criticism of the government, not only its response to these protests, but its role in society in the last 43 years. And so I haven't really seen a lot of support for the government in the campus community or the broader Sacramento community. There has been overwhelming support for the protesters.
How has this shaped how you teach in the classroom this semester?
Students have questions. I feel always an obligation to update people to the extent that they want to be updated in my classes. This semester, I'm teaching comparative politics. So there are certainly places that this discussion is vital. At the same time, next semester, I'm teaching Mideast politics at the grad and undergrad levels both. So we're going to have a whole unit on this in both classes. I think right now, the way that I'm teaching, the way I'm approaching the actual teaching of the subject is to try to give updates, give information, provide context, provide an overall framework for understanding the social movements that we're seeing. At the same time, you have to be kind of sensitive to what people are experiencing, because even if they are not Iranian students, many of them are intimately connected to the Iranian community. And it's a very sensitive and raw time for people right now, psychologically and emotionally. So you have to be cognizant of what people's responses are going to be overall.
Yeah, it is quickly evolving and taking shape and far from over. You know, when talking about how you teach comparative politics, you know, recently you were part of an event discussing local and transnational activism of Iranian women. Are you satisfied with the coverage that you've been seeing?
Overall, the short answer is not exactly. There's a tendency in reporting on Iran in the United States, especially, to just leave out large chunks of historical context that are important to understand what's happening. And there's also a tendency to kind of flatten Iranian society. So here in the U.S., we are less likely to see a huge distance between the people and the government, generally. In Iran, however, the kind of social and cultural norm is that there people accept that there is sometimes a vast, that the government doesn't represent the people, not just in a political way, but even in a strictly demographic way. And so here there's a lot of reporting on Iranians as if they are Iran, the government. And there's a lot of reporting on Iran, the government, the state, as if it is Iranian people. So I wish that reporting would be a little bit more nuanced in that way and a little bit provide a little bit more historical information.
Right, because it's been over four decades since even the Iranian Revolution back in 1979. And as I led with, a lot of these protests are being fueled by women, but also by youth.
Absolutely.
So many of them were not alive during this time. In what ways do you see that revolution from over 40 years ago influencing what's happening today?
The 1979 revolution was a broad-based grassroots, just a momentous kind of event. And right now we look back and we call it an Islamic revolution. But at the time, it was a movement for democracy. And a lot of people now feel disillusioned with what they got after that revolution. The people who are in the streets now, as you said, they weren't alive at the time. Many of them are under the age of 20. This is one of the reasons that we see so many detentions, and even several of the death sentences are for minors. However, they all have family members. They all have friends. They all have this broader historical memory about the violence that ensued in the process of the revolution and the consolidation of power by the clergy after the revolution. And so their disenchantment, their discontent, the kind of anguish of broken promises that maybe many of them never really believed were going to be fulfilled in the first place, but were beholden to try to carry through because they didn't have much individual power in the broader system. That anger is there. The pain and the trauma of the violence in the immediate years following 1979 is there. Mm-hmm. And I think, besides being very politically aware, they are also extremely really fueled by the pain of what has happened to their families and their societies. They all have cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents who were who fought in the revolution, who maybe were executed by the regime. Revolutions generally have maybe 3-7% public participation, the successful revolutions. Iran's was 11%, which I know doesn't sound like a lot to a lot of people, but within the literature, it's the highest we know in recorded modern history. So all of that is there. All of that political and social awareness is there driving people.
Do you think that also fuels, because 11% is significant, and it's not like, you know, you have to personally experience a revolution, but you also can experience it through prior generations and your ancestors, your parents and your grandparents and family members who went through this or suffered extreme loss. Do you think that explains, you know, the Iranian government's also extreme and violent response, even approving the option of a sentence of death penalty for protesters, you know, many of whom are youth children.
Yes, I do. I think that the clergy, they knew that they weren't the only game in town. They knew they weren't the only option. They were one of several different major groups that were competing for power in the wake of the departure of the Shah, or the ousting of the last king of Iran. And so at that time, there were a lot of maneuverings to get them to where they are now. And they know that that position is not solid. And so their goal, anytime there's a challenge to a state, any state, their options are to either, they have to adapt in some way. That adaptation can either be to yield a little bit in order to take some of the steam out or pacify the dissenters, the opposition, or to crack down harder. And the clergy has over and over and over again cracked down harder. And I think that's what they're doing now, too, because they've seen that it's worked for them in the past. But I don't think that it's working this time. They are hoping, they just sentenced 5 more to death yesterday for the killing of a Basij paramilitary member. And several of the people who are currently under death sentence are minors, 16 and 17 years old. I think the total that, as far to my knowledge, is 11 at this point, total. So a couple of those are 16 and 17 years old. And they're hoping this is going to raise the barriers to participation for the people in the streets. But it doesn't seem to be slowing people down. This week, there was a 3-day strike.
And that begins today, I believe, that already started
this week? Yeah.
And what does that strike look like? What does the strike in response to these protests look like across Iran?
So when the strike was called, it had been building for a little while, and then when it began, the shops closed down, the bazaars closed down in Isfahan and Tehran, some of the major cities, the capital city especially, some of the major hubs of commerce. Mm-hmm. In the urban centers, shut down, as well as even some of the peripheral areas. And what that really is doing is it's creating a broad-based solidarity. Usually the merchant class is not populated by 20-year-olds, right? The people in the streets and the merchant class who are closing their shops and their banks and their grocery stores and whatever else, they're not the same people. So to me, what this indicates is a growing of this movement across different generations and different sectors of society, which doesn't bode well for the regime.
And I would imagine across Iran and provinces, you know, there are political differences and there are more conservative areas of Iran.
Sure.
But now we're starting to see protests move into these more conservative provinces. Do you think it's, those residents kind of coming around, or do you think that they are finding the courage to actually express their views and show solidarity and show support for what's happening? Or is it more complicated than that?
I think it actually is a little bit more complicated than that. It depends on which area we're talking about. So some areas like Sistan-Baluchistan province, which shares a border with, there's a Pakistani Baluchistan, there's an Iranian Sistan-Baluchistan. Those areas have long been marginalized by the regime. And Baluchis are an ethnic minority that have been marginalized historically and subject to greater repression by the regime. So now we're seeing in the last month and a half, we're seeing protests and also violent crackdown in that province. And it's not because they are necessarily coming around, but because their grievances are now shared in a more meaningful way, shared grievances with the rest, rather than the protest movements that Sistan-Baluchistan has seen in the past, which are more about their treatment by the government. Mm. So I think that these different sectors, different provinces, areas being pulled in, each of them has maybe a slightly different kind of reason for it.
Yeah, as with most things, right? You know, it's very nuanced and there's a lot of gray area, and it's not, it's easy to simplify, but you're doing an injustice by simplifying it because it's way more nuanced than that. When you mentioned, you know, there's the option to yield, there's been some reports recently about, you know, quoting high-ranking government officials talking about disbanding the morality police,
right,
or disbanding or revising or removing the hijab law that was being reviewed. Both go back to Mahsa Amini, who died in Iranian morality police custody over allegedly not wearing a head covering properly. But both of these reports are being downplayed, even disputed. What are you hearing? I mean, do you think there's any truth within these reports?
Yeah, so I think when I first heard the news, I was really surprised. And my initial reaction was, even if this is true, it doesn't meaningfully change the political landscape because mandatory hijab would still be the law. And the morality police were established in 2005 by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Prior to that, we have had other groups, other governmental bodies that were responsible for policing hijab in public. In the 90s, in the 80s, it was called Comité. The Basij has done it. So even if that were true, it doesn't really represent a letting up or a yielding. However, because of my surprise, I went and I looked into what Montazeri actually said. And what he said was extremely ambiguous. To me, it sounded like he used the word ta'til, which can mean it can mean disbanding. It can also mean suspending. And even more so than that, it seems as if he was just kind of trying to get out from under the accountability for what the morality police and the broader kind of spectrum of security forces have been up to in Iran. So he said that, you know, the judiciary, which he is, that's who he represents. The judiciary is not responsible for the morality police, who they would be disbanded. He said they have been disbanded by, if we take Tatil as disbanded, that they've been disbanded by the same place that they originated from. But it's not, no other governmental body has confirmed that it's being abolished. And in fact, just yesterday, a representative in parliament said that in 2 weeks, a new form of hijab is going to be introduced in parliament, in Majlis. And there's my sense from that announcement was that it was going to be a stricter form of hijab. I guess it's possible that it might be a less strict form. But to me, it doesn't really look like anybody is yielding in the realm of hijab. I think that these reports kind of caught like wildfire that it was going to be abolished. But I'm not convinced that that's what's happening. And I don't think that the government really knows exactly what to do either at this point.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Professor Sahar Rezavi, director of the Iranian and Middle East Studies Center at Sacramento State, about the ongoing protests in Iran. You know, when it comes to the international community, the European Union announced more sanctions against government officials, condemning Tehran's use of force against protesters. I mean, Iran is no stranger to international sanctions as well as condemnation. But is there anything, do you have faith or optimism that the international community could actually have some weight in persuading the regime to meet some of the protesters' demands?
Yes and no. I think the international pressure matters. I absolutely think that international institutions and even norms do matter. I also think that the geopolitics of the international stage are kind of a necessary component as well to line up right now. So Iran, Russia, China, these are kind of the big bads in U.S. foreign policy, right? At least in U.S. discourse. Iran and Russia and Syria are also strongly tied. They're strongly allied. If the United States and the broader international community were able to get any one of those three, it would weaken the others. So I think that right now it behooves the international community to pressure Iran to change what it's doing on the ground. At the same time, if Iran doesn't want to yield in that way, if they can't be persuaded through these sanctions, through the calls to remove them from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women, if those kinds of measures aren't effective, I think there are also some more kind of realpolitik, traditional political measures that might be taken.
Given that Iran is also an influential country in the broader region, in the Middle East, are you seeing or do you think there'll be a broader impact of what these protests and also Iran's response to the protests, what they're having on surrounding countries in the Middle East?
Definitely. Historically, we know that revolutions tend to cluster together geographically and temporally. Typically, what people see on one side of a border happening on the other side influences them because there are similarities. They're not the same, certainly, but there are similarities with respect to culture, religion, institutions, political processes, social formations. When these protests began, a couple of weeks after they began, I saw a video of a group of women in Kabul in Afghanistan saying they were protesting. They had signs. It was a small group, but they had signs. And their chants were along the lines of, our sisters in Iran can protest, so can we. So I think that it's just one small indication that anytime historically we've seen this happen over and over again. Anytime there is a huge convulsion in one society across the border or in the broader region, there are downstream impacts. And that region generally struggles with democracy building of durable institutions for various reasons. And I think that if they see this protest and the government response, if they see this unfold in a way that works to the benefit of the people, it's likely that somewhere else in the region is going to have a similar kind of experience.
And global awareness continues. I mean, just going back to the World Cup in Qatar, the national soccer team remained silent during the national anthem before their opening match. And I believe their next match, they half-heartedly sang after receiving some pressure and some criticism from government officials. Do you think the World Cup brought more attention to what's happening to Iran and that it actually will have weight beyond the World Cup, beyond sports?
I do think that it brought attention. The World Cup is, as you know, just a massive global event. I don't know if it's going to have an impact beyond that at this point. I mean, the world of athletics, the world of soccer, it's an important one. And we have seen some major public figures like Ali Karimi, who is a kind of soccer star hero in Iran. He actually lives outside of Iran now because of his political speech inside of Iran, making the situation dangerous for him. There are impacts for sure, but I don't know that there is going to be a lot of ripples. There are going to be a lot of ripples outside of the soccer world now that the national team has been eliminated. I do think it was one arena that it was effective to bring attention to Iran. I don't think that now that they've been eliminated, attention is going to stop. I think that people who were already paying attention to what's happening there are still going to pay attention to what's happening there.
And just this morning, Time magazine, you know, they have their Person of the Year and Heroes of the Year. They named the women of Iran Heroes of the Year. What does that signify for you?
I was very moved by it. I think one thing is to call attention to what's happening, right? The people in Iran over and over again are asking us, Moro Tanha Nazari, don't leave us alone here. Don't abandon us. They want us to amplify their voices. They want people to have their eyes on what's happening. And I think Time magazine doing that is honoring that request in substance and in form. I hope, cautiously, I hope that it represents a greater awareness and a greater centering on the voices of the people who are in Iran fighting every day for their liberation. Because I think that sometimes we get a lot of signal and noise from other places, and we sort of we end up kind of forgetting that the people really at stake here are the ones who live there, who have to live every single day with the consequences of what's happening.
Dr. Razavi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Professor Sahar Razavi is the director of the Iranian and Middle East Studies Center at Sacramento State, discussing the very latest on the protests in Iran. Still ahead, the city of Sacramento provides an update on its African American Experience Project and shares more details of the first historical analysis of the city's rich Black history. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This year, the city of Sacramento launched an ambitious historical review of African American history to highlight the significant contributions of Black Sacramentans from the city's earliest years through the 20th century. Before the African American Experience Project began, the city lacked a historic framework to preserve Sacramento's Black experience for future generations. Recently, the project achieved a big milestone in this effort, releasing the first public draft of its historic context statement, an initial outline that will eventually help the city preserve buildings and other landmarks of Black cultural and historical significance in Sacramento. Joining us now with the progress report and to talk to us about this document is Carson Anderson, co-director of the African American Experience Project. Good morning, Carson.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
And I have the report in my hands. Thank you for bringing a print version of it.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it. When we first discussed this project on Inside, it was back in August. Remind us what the African American Experience Project is and what its ultimate goal is.
Yes, we received a grant from the National Trust for Historic Preservation to undertake an overview history of Black Sacramento. We scoped it to begin in the middle of the 19th century and move forward through around about 1980 or thereabouts.
And you're also the former historic preservation director, correct, for the city of Sacramento?
That's correct, yes. From 2016 through last year, when I retired, I was the director of the preservation program.
Well, your retirement was pretty short-lived because now you're co-director of this project. It's not that much time. What brought you out of retirement and back helping the city with something like this?
It was such an exciting endeavor for me. I have kind of a track record of working on ethnic historical documentation down in Southern California, in particular for the city of Pasadena and Los Angeles, and was involved with the Survey LA efforts about 10 years ago to document various ethnic communities and the LGBTQ community there. So when this opportunity arose, I said, I'm available. Bring me in as needed, and I'll help out.
And now you have a historic context statement. It's the first draft. What does this accomplish? How do you explain this to people who are learning about this for the first time?
Yes, the big fancy professional name is Historic Context Statement. It's basically an overview history of Black Sacramento, and it provides a discussion based on historical themes. So where did people come from? Where did they settle at various points in time in the city? So that's one of the themes that we're looking at. What were the businesses? How did business development over 100 years of history change and morph? What were the institutions that were established? What were the churches? When did they form? What were the civic organizations to advance civil liberties? What were the civil rights-related struggles that occurred? These are all various themes that this overview history talks about. And then finally, kind of the celebrities that came out of Sacramento and the arts and culture and sports arenas. And we found quite a few very interesting names of Sacramentans who went on to major careers in the cultural arts and sports arenas.
Given that, like, your wheelhouse is preservation and preserving history and culture across, I mean, you were talking about going down to Southern California, and now you're doing this in Sacramento. When you actually read through this report, the first draft, was there anything that resonated with you or even surprised you when flipping through it?
I was surprised at the pervasiveness of slavery in the United States in the middle of the 19th century. As you know, the state was admitted as a free state to the Union, but slaveholders from the South were able to bring their slaves into California, and provided they didn't overstay, you know, more than a year or so, they were allowed to take those slaves and have them work for them as enslaved persons and then remove them back to the South.
And so time is relative. A year is a long time.
It is. And so one of the names that popped out was Archie Lee in the effort to obtain his freedom from slavery. He was brought here back in the 1850s, I believe it was, mid-1850s. So that persistence of slavery, even in a free state, was a surprise, as were some of the things like, for example, not funding public school education for Black and Native American and Asian American school children. These communities had to band together to lobby the city's Board of Education and the state legislature to change laws and policies so their children can be educated in public schools.
And when a big topic of conversation or increasing topic of conversation has been looking at housing discrimination and racial covenants across the country, but in Sacramento included, did this draft compiling this this piece of history in the city of Sacramento, did it deepen your understanding of the impact and the history that racial covenants have had on the city of Sacramento?
It really did. Seeing all the layers of history, documenting the discrimination, the segregation, even here in California, I think a lot of people would be surprised at the depth of policies, practices, laws, the zoning decisions, the placement of highways through minority neighborhoods, the restrictions on where people could live, even when racial restrictive covenants were lifted, even when redlining practices that determined the ability to get loans to buy properties or improve them, even when those things were struck away in the courts, there were still social practices. Real estate brokers steering people of color to one neighborhood versus a neighborhood which was majority white. So when you add up all these things over decades of time, you get a very nuanced, very detailed idea of sort of the institutional mechanisms of racism and segregation at work here.
And this first draft of the analysis, it looks at the African-American community from the 19th century through 1980. Why not the 1990s and 2000s?
Historians have a practice of excluding things from the recent past because there is an assumption that we don't have a strong enough historical record, enough analysis, or enough distance historically to be able to look at things in an objective way and evaluate them. So that was one of the reasons for it. And then we get into the recent past and we have way more items to evaluate than we have budget, time, staffing, volunteers to cover. So our hope is that this will be for a first effort and that it will inspire the community and scholars to launch future efforts to document things from the recent past as well.
And when it comes to the community, you recently held a public meeting in the neighborhood of Meadowview in Sacramento. What was some of the feedback that you received from this draft?
You know, it's really interesting, Vicki. We've had four public meetings thus far. All four of them have been very, very distinct. We had a meeting where people were just very suspicious of what we were doing and critical, and they offered some very good suggestions on how to conduct future meetings and where to hold them and what resources to look at to strengthen our analysis. We had another meeting in Del Paso Heights, which where a lot of emotions were evoked because they were remembering and sharing with us how much of their community was lost during the 1990s and in the early 2000s as businesses closed down, as levels of crime and fear occurred and disinvestment occurred and people moved away from the community. And then this last meeting was more listening. People were just eagerly awaiting what we had to say about the report and our initial findings and were asking how to be involved, how to further this effort, how they could participate in it.
Well, Carson, thank you so much for joining us with the progress report. We look forward to learning more about the African-American experience in the city of Sacramento in the months and years to come.
My pleasure. Thanks again for having me.
Carson Anderson is co-director of the City of Sacramento's African American Experience Project. We have provided a link to the project on our website, our Insight page. And with that, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Carell Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.